Herzlich willkommen zum Beyond 20XX Podcast. Dieser Podcast wird Ihnen präsentiert von SIS, The Interface Society, dem Artificial Intelligence Center ARIC und Umlaut.
Wir nehmen mit verschiedenen Gastgebern und Experten den Public Sector unter die Lupe. Woher kommen wir, wo stehen wir und wo geht die Reise hin?
Ja, da sind wir wieder mit dem Beyond Podcast 20XX. Heute tatsächlich mal mit einem englischsprachigen Gast, mit Darian Akins. Did I pronounce it the right way?
That is correct.
Perfect. Er ist Consul General oder Generalkonsular, Konsul würden wir auf Deutsch sagen, im kleinen weißen Haus an der Alster. Und now we're going to switch to English. Welcome. Great that you're here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I heard you're a podcaster yourself.
I do. We do. Officially, the U.S. consulate here in Hamburg has a podcast called Alster 27, which is our address.
Oh, great.
Of course, Alois is here as well.
Hi. So. Moin zusammen.
You're a podcaster as well.
Right.
So, perfect. Great that we made it here on a Friday with a nice coffee, and we decided not to start beers yet. But we tried to kind of hit the public sector again and talk about what your perception is about the German or European or even Hamburg public sector and what your ideas and opinions might be are already. And yeah, let me know, like, how are you involved in the public sector in Hamburg or Germany?
Well, should I just describe a little bit about maybe perhaps what I do first?
Yes.
That
might be a really good idea.
Good. So, yeah, I mean, as you pointed out, I'm the U.S. Consul General here in Hamburg, but I am responsible for the five northern states of Germany. So Hamburg, Bremen, Schleswig-Holstein, Niedersachsen, and Mecklenburg-Vorpommern. And the way I like to describe what I do is in two parts. I am a listener and I am an explainer. So the first part is I meet officials, like public officials, business leaders, science leaders, and I listen. And I take that information back and I deliver it to the embassy or to Washington, D.C., so that we can inform policymakers about how effective our policies are. And if people take issue with some of our policies and said, well, we don't like this or we support this policy. And that's the other side. So then I have to sometimes explain U.S. policy. And sometimes that's it's a very good conversation and a lively conversation. And other times it's a challenging conversation.
Yeah, but you're a diplomat, right? So you learned how to do that.
One would hope.
So what is your perception when you look at Hamburg or Germany, like, or even the German states, like federal states you're looking at?
I think the thing that has struck me the most is how innovative and dynamic Northern Germany is, particularly here in Hamburg. I think a lot of Americans, for example, know about Hamburg through its port. Mm. But I think, you know, as I arrived here, it became clear within a few months that there was a lot more happening here, from digitalization to renewable energy to entrepreneurism. I've been particularly interested in entrepreneurism and individuals in Northern Germany saying, you know, this, we need to take more risks, and this is about building companies and institutions of the future. So we've been participating with commerce, like chambers of commerce around Northern Germany on this effort.
So my perception when it comes to entrepreneurship is always like, in Germany it's like more this inventors, like this Mittelstand thing.
Yeah.
It's not like they don't really in the first instance think about scaling. Right. Or they might not even consider themselves as founders of a startup. They just think, I had an idea and it would make total sense to have a company here, right? So I need a company to have an account to kind of earn money with that.
No, it's interesting that you say that because, I mean, I've had a couple dinners where I've invited entrepreneurial-minded people to dinner. And it was interesting. One individual who started his own company, it's worth quite a bit of money, like hundreds of millions of euros. And he said, the challenge is, you're right, he said, typically Germans like it to be perfect. We want it to be just this, what I've planned, what I thought about. And he said, the problem is by the time you bring that to the market, there's some other company who said, well, good enough is okay, and I'm going to market. And then it doesn't work. So he did say to me, it's just, we just need to feel a little bit more comfortable taking the risk in the beginning.
Yeah, I think that's a lot we can learn between like Europe and in general and the States. I've been to this IVLP thing and I learned a lot about how the culture in the States works. And that was my perception that they like, oh, let's do it. I give it a try. I don't have a clue yet, but I will have it tomorrow. And then you're like, I need to be a super expert.
But I think one of the places where we bring people together is I've seen some wonderfully innovative, creative individuals, met with them. They have started their own companies, but they are starting to think of in terms of scale. And what I've had specific conversations about is like, how do we potentially maybe bring venture capitalists into this? Because it's hard for them to sometimes receive funding in Germany because the banks like to see that you've been successful for a couple of years before they'll loan you money. And as we know, statistically, you know, most startups will fail in the first 2 years. So that's not really taking the risk that's necessary. So we've been having conversations like, how can we bring, you know, the elements of American and how we approach innovation and creativity and the German version of innovation and creativity, and then make something that where we both benefit.
Yeah. Therein, what could be the role of the government in this kind of entrepreneurial thinking and supporting?
My view is it's absolutely critical for a government to just give the vision and then allow the individuals themselves to decide, what that means to me is this, or I see the contribution that I can make is X. And so my view would be the government shouldn't be too specific. Just provide the vision and allow people to do by trial and error, and that will spur innovation and actually happen fairly quickly, in my view.
So the government should be more a rainmaker, not really involved into the process, but connecting the dots, kind of.
Yeah, and then I think the one way to look at it is the government provides the vision and then plays referee, like, that's a strike, or that's a ball, or that's a foul ball, to use baseball analogy, which simply means they will say, oh, that's outside the scope, you went too far, that's you need to bring that back in, this is what we more or less had in mind. I think that's the role of the government, always making sure that it's providing the sort of benefit that the government envisioned. But remember, I mean, at the end of the day, a government in a democracy is always representing the people. So this is about, well, is this in the interest of society, and how is it, and always, you know, making sure that it fits within that realm.
Yeah. But referee very often sounds like regulation. And we just touched this kind of topic. So how far could regulations go? For example, if we look at AI, we have in Europe, there's an upcoming act on artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts about this kind of regulations? Is it too much, or is it this kind of referee doing that you described?
I think it's still the referee. AI is a very good example, in my opinion, where if we're not clear at, well, I think that we can see some problems with AI if it develops in a certain way. And we see some of those already. For example, certain AI facial recognition programs only recognize certain races, or better races, you know, one race better than another, or is better at recognizing men than women, right? And that's because we have to make sure that as it's developed, we're thinking about all these individuals who may come in contact with that. So the role that the government can simply play is to say, look, in general, we want it to support human rights. We want it to support individual freedoms. We want it to support, you know, societal prosperity and not be used to oppress people or to surveil people, for example.
You have to align it with the values of a society, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. When it comes like when you just compare like your view on that, like the regulations in Europe and the regulation in the States, do they differ a lot when it comes to the demand for regulation?
You know, I recently had this conversation with an individual, and here was his take, and I felt like it was pretty accurate. He said, in the States, we allow companies and institutions to go forward and do whatever it is they think is in their interest to do. And we only stop them when they have made a file, that they've done something that the government says, wait, that's not in our interest. You've gone too far. And then that's when the regulations come in. Then in the US, then they will develop the regulation after the fact, not before. So something has to happen that was not anticipated nor deemed necessarily good for society, and then the regulations come. The regulations don't come at the beginning because we feel that that may stifle.
So it hits in when it's needed, like at the point where it's needed, right?
That's a view. That would be our view, but right. You know.
Yeah. I think it's a very pragmatic approach. And since it's a cultural, like, I don't know, in Europe might be a bit different. We try to regulate everything in advance. It's right. My perception as well. A good example, I think, is this Data Protection Act. Mm-hmm. Where big companies or even small companies really get like big fees, big fines actually, if they kind of have a little issue there, because the regulation is not as fast as a private players, right?
Right.
As a companies who actually develop it, so they want to kind of create a atmosphere of fear, kind of within the company decision makers, so that they don't want to kind of be the first one trying out something new because they are maybe afraid to make this leap.
And I think that we try to engender the opposite attitude. We try to say, go forth, make mistakes, do trial and error, and we'll let you know when that doesn't work for us. We'll let you know when we feel you've made a mistake.
I think like personally, and at some point of time, we're going to need like a common approach because AI, when you think it, like I think a few years in the future, it might be something that actually everybody on this planet has to deal with, especially when it comes to infrastructure. When you look at Starlink, like Elon Musk and all the other, his competition, they are building this infrastructure of satellites. So we are all connected with the very same infrastructure. Mm. So we're going to be confronted with the very same AI at some point of time. Mm. So I think at some point of time, all the international countries and ideas need to be aligned somehow.
Well, and I think that that's why it's critical, particularly in my view, for democracies to decide what their values are and to make sure that they defend those values and fight for those values. Because as AI has developed, you're absolutely correct that if we don't, we can find that there's only a few players and they're already going in a direction that's maybe undermining democracy or isn't supportive of our values as democracies. And that's something to be very conscious of.
Yeah, maybe this is a really interesting aspect about the big techs and their dominance. How do you think a good regulation could work so that we have still like a democratic system and we have still companies, startups, SMEs that are that can challenge them and so on?
No, I think the answer is the same, which is allow them to make the mistake. I mean, they don't know, right? When I have a new technology and I don't know what all the possibilities are. And so companies will say, oh, I can produce this product or this product. And oh, wait, now I can do this. And it isn't until, 5-10 years later sometimes that we realize, maybe that's not in our interest. Or actually, society is harmed by that, and then we have to address it. And then I know some people feel, well, we could have anticipated that. Well, perhaps, but we didn't know exactly who, which companies, when, how long would it take, and is that really a good approach? When there's all these variables, unknown variables at the beginning, let's just see and then react to it. That's my view.
Yeah, like Henry Ford said, if I would ask the people what they want, we would still ride horses, right? It's kind of, but yeah. But what just happened, like, of course, we are not up to date, like very up to date here when we actually sent this podcast out to you. So we did it a few days in advance. So today was the announcement of Facebook having like Meta. And Meta will be, the vision is to end up in the metaverse. Mm. Metaverse is like, let's say, a digital country for everyone. Mm. So everybody, so we're going to face some problem for regulators, because right now we're going to hit this very interesting spot where we need alignment. Because in the metaverse, if everybody participate there, everybody should be equal in this metaverse. Mm. So if there's how you want to kind of have a regulation there that really treats people different.
Yeah. But I think that we are starting to see some of this alignment, or at least the discussions are taking place. So, for example, you know, the US, the EU, and Germany are having these conversations about what is privacy, how do we want to go about this, how do we protect data. But again, with these general values in mind of, well, wait, we want to have these discussions and we want to make sure that we protect people. However, we want to do it in a way that does not stifle innovation. And that's where the conversation gets challenging.
Yeah, and I think it's a specific fire starter right now with this digital world coming up. Mm, yes. Because this is a new, a different dimension, actually, because I think a lot of politicians really don't take it into account right now.
Right.
Like, yeah. Okay, something is happening there, what you described in advance. Something is developing there. People are jumping on the train. What we do now? And I think they will just notice, like, when it's way too late again.
Yeah, I mean, that's just this. It's a difference in approach, right? It's not to say that one is wrong and the other is right. It's just that simply one is optimized for one action, which in the case of the United States, innovation is optimized for to the greatest extent. We want to optimize, you know, the lack of regulations to support innovation. And I think maybe in the EU, maybe in Germany, that is, there are things that we want to avoid if we can foresee them.
Mm-hmm.
And neither way is wrong. It's just one lends itself to quick innovation and the other does not.
Apart from AI and all these metaverse stuff we talked about, like, what are topics you're really interested in? Like, you said entrepreneurship, you said AI is an interesting topic. Like, what do you think should be something we should have a specific glance at?
Well, I think, so, and this is a general point of view that undergirds everything. So when we talk about the transatlantic relationship, for example, one of the things that is key to me is that it needs to be reformatted. Very often when I started in my position, very often when I would go to speeches of politicians and so forth, it would start with after World War II or after the fall of the wall.
Right.
And I really felt that was not the best approach. My approach has been, no, we should be talking about the issues that are impacting people today and the issues that concern them today. So I've learned that in a lot of cases it's climate change, it's technological innovation, is how quickly are we going to be able to transform our economy to green energy. That needs to be the basis of the new transatlantic relationship that takes us for the next 75 years on the initiatives that we're working with. Now, let me say, that doesn't mean that history is not important. History is important. History is used to inform us, have we seen these sorts of initiatives in the past? And I would say, okay, let's say Germany, the U.S., and our allies working together for the fall of the wall. Well, that was a decades-long initiative. What sort of policies did we have? How did we align our policies? What sort of institutions did we build? How long did this take? Well, that helps to inform us when we say, oh, we have this challenge with climate change that won't be solved tomorrow, But based upon history, here's some of the things that we can do. Here are the institutions that we need. Here's the dialogue we need. Here are the people that need to be involved. Right? That's a helpful conversation, because the people who feel like I'm impacted today will say, I understand that and I can contribute to that. And that's the other portion. You know, in democracies, we want the people involved. We want them feeling like I can contribute to the solution. And so you have to have the discussion in, you know, where they are and about the issues that impact them. If I start with, well, after World War II, I wasn't born. So I learned that in history class, but it's important, but it doesn't really impact me, right?
Yeah, of course. Like, of course, we learned that history always repeats itself. So we try to learn from that. That should be like the baseline, kind of. And now the challenge is kind of to grow together, like for the big new challenges of humanity, right? When it comes to AI, what we talked about, when it comes to sustainable, we know, okay, our planet just has some specific amount of resources. And now we need not a greenwashing approach, we need a pragmatic approach. I have to do with global players who are really have a lot of respect when it comes to this challenge. They are facing that because they know they will need to, and they want to be at the forefront of doing that, because they want to be a part of this process to kind of create it, right? To have some influence in that.
Right.
Of course, but it seems to me that they kind of understood that they are part of this equation and they need to have a responsible role. Mm-hmm. Of course, it needs regulation, otherwise it won't happen, because there's always somebody not doing it and they would just move there. So what is your perception when it comes to that?
This kind of goes back to the one of the first questions that you posed. I think here's where this vision comes into play, right? So let's talk about the moonshot, where the U.S. said, well, we're going to put a man on the moon in 10 years. That gives everyone a sense of I'm involved, that we're as a society working toward this. And no matter what you do, no matter what your station is in life, you feel a part of that. And I think that that's one of the more important things. And we have similar initiatives today. So, for example, the modern version of the moonshot today is the Earthshot, which is to trying to reduce the price of hydrogen energy to below $1 per kilo. At that price, a majority of industries can use it efficiently and be able to profitably produce their goods and wares. And then we're reducing our carbon footprint. And so, like, people being aware of that, discussing it, and thinking, oh, this is a role I can play, I can contribute to that, this is something that is going to be for the benefit of everyone, that's the important part. Trying to get everyone to feel I'm involved and I have a role to play and I can contribute, whether I be a business or just an individual.
So today a lot is about, like, storytelling. We would need, like, a story for humanity to kind of really have a focal point. Like, I want this new moonshot. Because, like, at the moment, of course, when you look in the internet, everybody's talking about sustainability. Then you have some hardcore guys who say, okay, and then you have everything's forbidden now, which is not a solution as well. Extreme opinions always, like, tend to kind of separate people, right? But I think the challenge will have to develop, like, a common, a general opinion about that, and to really have everybody, like most of the people at least, on board to focus that, and to really have this moment, like, now we do that. Mm-hmm. Now, a hands-on moment in history, that's something we need to face on.
But I think that we are beginning to do that. When you look at our governments in particular, where we're saying as democracies, we have these shared challenges, we have these shared interests, let's sit down and talk about what they are so that we can be clear about how we defend them and how we advance those interests. And I think that involves everybody. Everyone gets to play a role and say, yeah, that's important to me. And so the very conversations that you're talking about are taking place, but it's just that it may not be very visible to the general population. But those conversations have started, and I think that you know, where we are, we're starting to define what do we mean, and how are we going to work together, and what are we trying to achieve at the end of it? What do we want to see at the end of that cooperation? So that conversation is taking place.
And if you look at different stakeholders, it's still very often a conversation between a small group of stakeholders. So what is your idea about how to involve different stakeholders? Yeah, for example, like the young generation that is on the streets right now because of their issues. And do you have some ideas about how to involve them and how to give them a voice?
Well, I can only tell you what I do. So I think that might be the... So I agree with that. That is something that we do need to do. So how do I do that in my daily work is I have what's called a youth advisory council. It was started by my predecessor, but it's where we bring in high school students and speak with them once a month. And they get... No topics are off the table. They can talk about whatever they want to talk about, any topic, and I will answer. It's a
like in this situation, right?
Like in this conversation, yeah. Right, exactly in this conversation. Yeah. And why do I do that? Because it is extremely important for young people not to just share their opinions, but for them to feel that they're making a contribution. So we then say, well, how do we turn that into action? What do we do? Like, it can be exchange programs where we decide, okay, well, how would you like to go to the U.S. or have Americans come here and exchange, and they live in each other's households, right? That's a concrete solution. That's how you feel like, I'm making a difference. So if one of those students, and we have one right now, we have one of our former YAC members is currently in my home state of Texas, in an exchange program at a high school for the next year, right? And that's a concrete contribution. When she comes back, she understands how the U.S. works. She understands the views that are being expressed in the U.S. and why people hold those views. And she can explain that to people here in Germany so that we have a greater understanding. And that's how you make a contribution.
So we have actually even an intergenerational thing here we have to solve, right? So first of all, we should kind of solve the intergenerational opinion about this. Then we have to kind of develop at least a mindset in the Western world and kind of align with Russia, China, and all these, because it wouldn't make sense to have like a race to the bottom, because when all the big companies can't do what they want anymore in the Western world, some of them would move, right? So, and I think this will be one of the biggest challenge of maybe our lifetime. We're sitting here.
No, but let's be clear. There is a tremendous difference between a functioning democracy and an autocracy, or you know, ruled by an autocrat. There's a tremendous difference, and we should be clear-eyed about those differences and be clear in explaining to those who live in democracies what it means. Because I think sometimes people forget, because I know in the U.S. we take it for granted. I mean, we have the Bill of Rights. Everyone knows we have 10, the first 10 amendments of the Constitution is our Bill of Rights. Everyone knows that. But what does it mean? What does it mean? And people can tend to forget that these rights are just, they're a part of society, but they also have to be defended. They have to be understood. And the way I try to encapsulate what a democracy means to me is it's not about me being able to express my opinion. That's not the basis of a democracy for me. The basis of a democracy is my ability to listen to you and disagree with you and yet continue to have a conversation with you to try and find a common solution.
So technology would be even a chance to solve that even for autocratic states, because what I understood, like when you, for example, have the metaverse, right, where everybody can kind of participate if they have the technical means to do so, and if there's no governments who have even more the technical means to stop that, then they should learn about their participation, their role in a democratic process, and they could be advocates for that in their country.
Yeah, I mean, generally, we had this view about, so what, in the 1970s, Nixon goes to China and says we want to open up dialogue with China. And eventually along this path, we said, yes, we agree that China should become part of the GATT. And then we said, okay, we're going to give China most favored trading status so that they had a favorite trading status with the United States. And then we said, yes, we agree to their ascension to the WTO. But why did we do this? We did this because we were thinking, yes, as the society moves forward, as individuals become more involved, that they would tend toward democracy. That was our view. We haven't really seen that play out because technology now plays a role. You can see where technology allows governments now to control, you know, what comes in through the internet, what goes out through the internet, what I can see, what I can't see. There are governments that do that. So, you know, we can say that it does make a difference. Technology is definitely playing a role and giving governments tools that they didn't necessarily have in the past. And so we have to be aware about that, and we have to be aware about the challenges of that for democracy. So we have to be clear that those are things that we don't support. We want individual freedoms. We want people to have the freedom of expression. And those are all rights that are guaranteed to us, for example, in the German Constitution or in the American Constitution, but those are not necessarily rights that are guaranteed for everybody.
True. Like when we take a look, for example, at the crypto market, if you like it or not, but it's like a, let's say most of the parts are not really regulated yet. Like some countries try to regulate it or forbid it, but there's always a dark market. That's where it's kind of coming from. So is there a race between the countries, like in really ramping up their efforts to become technical leaders, like another, I don't want to say Cold War, but when it comes to like ramping up the efforts and having nerds in the government, kind of.
No, there's competition. There's competition, but excuse me. So when you talk about this space, I mean, it gets back to our idea that we talked about at the very beginning. What's the U.S.'s overall vision? Our overall vision is, and we say it, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? That's what we say. And you have this ability where we want to create a prosperous society, and we allow people to innovate, to create, to do what they want. And there are some constraints on that to make sure that the society stays together. But generally, we want people to feel like I can do what I would like to do. And that is a positive development. That's our vision, that everyone can kind of pursue whatever it is in their life that's going to make it better for them, more prosperous for them, whatever that is, you know? We don't try to predetermine that. Those three things, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that's pretty broad.
Yeah,
it's not very specific.
It's a chance. I try to put it in other words. The chance that I see when it comes to technology is that, of course, when we give people access to technology, they can compare their system they're living in to other systems, right? And they could decide for themselves, like freely, at least in the digital world, what would be the preferred, like, for example, democracy versus autocracy, right?
Right. But do we all have that ability? do we all have freedom of access? Do we all have the freedom to be able to compare? Do we all have freedom of information where I can access it, access that information in order to make that comparison?
So that should be the challenge, kind of, to really give people access and this choice in the future, right? So I would say we in the Western world would bet that the horse democracy would win. That would be the hope, I think. Yeah. But it would be nice if everybody would have the access, if we could guarantee the access and the choice, like what team are you playing? So and
yeah, but how do you guarantee that? That becomes the question. I mean, we can do that amongst democracies, and that's again, I talked about this, where democracies where we're having those conversations now, right? About our shared interests, shared challenges. But not everyone is involved in that conversation because some people cannot be involved in that conversation.
Yeah, big challenge we're facing.
Yeah, and maybe coming back to the very beginning, you said that you've seen so many Northern Germany like states and experienced so much. So where do we lag behind? What do you see where the potential, because you said that we are innovative here in Northern Germany and that it's going the right direction, but do you see any points where you would just say, okay, that's maybe something we lag behind?
I wouldn't characterize it as lagging behind. I would just simply say that, I think that, you know, Germany takes a methodical approach. And I see that. So, and I've also learned that whenever we talk about, okay, let's have a conference on an issue, and I may be thinking we can do this next month, and they may think, okay, next year, because we have to plan it out. We have to decide who's going to be involved, and we have to have those. And I understand it. It's just a difference in approach, and people have their level of comfort. And I would definitely say that, you know, Northern Germans have their level of comfort. And if pushed quickly on an issue, they're not going to feel comfortable. And so it's as you said to me in the very beginning of the podcast, you know, feel comfortable, right? You want everyone to feel comfortable when you're dealing with a cooperative process,
right?
You know, and so I wouldn't characterize it as lagging behind. You just always have the challenge of everyone's different. And as a diplomat who's served in 6 different countries, I've lived in 8 different countries, and I've visited too many to count. and I can just tell you that everybody has their particular way. And so the conversation that is necessary is, what's the end state? What are we trying to achieve together? And now we're going to have the conversation about how do we get there, right? And for Americans, I would say, yeah, we tend to move pretty quickly, which is not a comfortable place for a lot of countries that I've dealt with, or a lot of individuals that I've dealt with. That's not how they approach issues.
Interesting. Yeah. So how to take care to get the right people on board for this process?
Here I'll go back to my experiences working overseas. It is a good idea to come in with your own plan. The key to having your own plan is not that you say, well, I'm going to argue only for my plan, and my plan has to be the one accepted. You come with a plan because it gives you a clear idea about what you're trying to achieve. You want the person who's on the other side of the table to come with their plan. But the whole idea is, what are we trying to achieve? We should agree on the vision ahead of time.
Right.
If we can agree on the vision ahead of time, you come with your plan, I come with my plan, and we'll figure out the rest. If we are dealing in good faith, I am absolutely certain we can get there. How? Now, here's the issue. some issues that we face today are urgent. And so that is part of the vision where we have to say, okay, climate change is a problem and it needs to be addressed. But I would actually put in the qualifier of it needs to be urgently addressed.
Right.
Right? And I would put in the qualifier, we need to address this within X number of years. And we need to agree on that vision first. That have that conversation first. And you allow each side to bring whomever they believe are the important players to bring to the table. I shouldn't decide for sure. for someone I'm negotiating with, oh, well, you can only bring someone. No, that's let them bring who they believe are the most effective representatives at that table. Let them decide that. And I'll decide for me. But we have to have this idea, what is it that we are trying to achieve together? We have to agree on that first.
You set an anchor, kind of.
Yes.
This is the topic, this is this urgency.
Right.
And that's what we're discussing. And so you bring something to the table, which is way better than nothing. Like I know that from business talks, when you have a hypothetical idea or concept,
yep.
Everybody has an opinion about that, but they all have a totally different perception. So, but if you have something, and even if the people are not aligned with that, it's something to, you have a basis, a foundation you can discuss upon, right? And if you have two, you can compare them. And it makes way easier for people, even if they're totally opposite opinion, to find a solution, right?
Yeah.
I would just like to add in a new aspect, and this is the topic of innovation ecosystems. Mm-hmm. And as we all know, it's been talked a lot about Silicon Valley as an incubator and innovation hotspot. And what I would find very interesting is, what is your opinion about other hotspots where something similar or innovative happens?
I mean, they definitely exist around the world. I don't know if it's worth me enumerating them, but because I don't want to look like I'm advantaging one over another. But look, I can say this. I think it's actually positive. I mean, if you look in the United States, we always talk about Silicon
right.
Valley, but let's be honest. I mean, even within the United States, there are competition for innovative centers. So Austin is one of those new centers. Boston is an innovative center, particularly for healthcare. So Silicon Valley has its competition too, and having global competition in regards to how do we innovate, how do we create, you know, how do we think about the big challenges of the future, that's positive. Having a number of centers around the world that are thinking about issues, the same issues, but they may think about them and look at them differently, that's a positive development in my mind.
Yeah, sometimes I have sometimes perception of Hamburg, like we're here in Hamburg and I really love the city, but sometimes Hamburg has a lot to deal with just Hamburg, right?
Yeah.
So what I hear miss sometimes that they are to kind of connect worldwide with other hotspots and really try to learn and have some synergy.
International scopes, right?
Yeah. Well, but they do. Yeah. I mean, for
they
example,
they do definitely.
No,
but
yeah.
There could be more, maybe.
Well, I mean, but they are. I mean, from my experience, they are creating those connections. They have them. So, for example, there's the Innovation Office in San Francisco, that is supported by Hamburg, Bremen, and Schleswig-Holstein,
mm-hmm.
right? So that creates those connections so that they can work on introducing companies to work on these issues together, how to innovate, what are the areas in which they're going to innovate. So we see this. And we are seeing more of those connections being created. For example, also Chicago and Hamburg are sister cities, and they've been so for the last 26 years, and they've recently expanded their partnership to include an economic component in the areas of logistics, transportation, and distribution, right? So they're creating those connections because they're saying, look, as large cities, we're facing some of the same challenges. How do we create a digital environment? How do we become a smart city? Sharing those ideas and common practices and best practices is in both cities' interest to do.
Yeah. Awesome. So I think I just take a look at the watch. We're already like a little bit over time.
It was so interesting that we couldn't stop. Yeah.
It was really a big pleasure to have you, Darren.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And yeah, I hope you guys could follow up, even if it was in English. But yeah, we're looking forward to have you as listeners, of course, soon again. And yeah, now I switch to German. Dankeschön fürs Zuhören und wenn ihr das Ganze mögt, teilt gerne das Ganze natürlich auf Social Media und ladet eure Leute ein, hier zuzuhören und ja, wir freuen uns aufs nächste Mal. Bis dahin. Tschüss.
Vielen Dank, Darren. Tschüss.
Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und das Interesse an unserem Podcast. Solltet ihr oder Sie Fragen oder Anmerkungen zu dem Podcast haben, schreibt eine E-Mail an podcast@beyond20xx.com. Gern stellen wir euch auch den Kontakt zu unseren Gästen her, sollte es ein begründetes Interesse geben. Bis zum nächsten Mal, euer oder ihr Beyond20XX-Team.